New Year. I appreciated Wayne's message. I found myself struggling with that phrase this year. So thank you for that perspective. I hope with the title, Let's Get Stoned, that nobody is disappointed this morning, that it's maybe a little different than what it sounds like. But let's get stoned. There's a fact that you may be aware of, but might not fully appreciate. How many of you have walked on a beach in the last few days or week? Anybody? I have, yeah. We've been lucky. It's not been too snowy or icy down there. Every time you've walked on that beach, when you walked on that beach, you have been walking in a time capsule of sorts. The dry land that you're walking on used to be the bottom of the sea. As glaciers and water came and went, the land was carved out along with the oceans and the lakes. You'll read in the bulletin a quote from 19th century geologist James Dwight Dana. Beneath the soil and waters of the earth's surface, there is everywhere a basement of rocks. Our own Great Lakes are somewhere between 7,000 and 34,000 years old, with water starting to fill the basins around 14,000 years ago. And really, that sounds like a lot, but it's really not. It's like, you know, a little drop in the ocean. Lake Michigan rose to the levels that we know it now about 3,000 years ago. The sand on our Lake Michigan beaches is around 5,000 years old. So every time you're stepping on that sand, you're walking on something that's 5,000 years old. On other beaches around the world, its age varies, the sand age varies from a few thousand to millions of years old. The rocks on those beaches, those chunks of earth that have come from ancient volcanoes and mud and clay from the ocean floor and fossilized marine organisms, those are millions and some of them billions of years old. Can you imagine if these stones could talk? They have seen everything. And where else outside of a museum can we experience, let alone hold in our hand, an object that's a billion years old? Now, I've been collecting Petoskey stones, and Petoskey stones are about 350 million years old. So there's 350 million years. I've been collecting them for a few years now. We have a rustic family cabin on West Grand Traverse Bay that's fortunate enough to have a stretch of beach that we have easy access to. And we can walk up and down that beach, and there are thousands of rocks and a few Petoskey stones. And I started just by picking up the Petoskeys and pretty much ignoring everything else. But then slowly other rocks started catching my eye, and I started to pick up the granite and the agate and the jasper. And once I had a few pounds of rocks, I decided it was time to get a tumbler. Now, how many of you have tumbled rocks? Okay, a small portion of you. So you're going to get what I'm talking about here as I talk about sort of a metaphorical approach to what we can learn from tumbling. But I finally bought that tumbler in November, and I ran my first full batch in the month of December. I'm going to ask Jeannie to start passing around this bowl. The bowl is the lovely walnut bowl that was a gift for my board service. So it's a C3 bowl. And the rocks that are in it are the rocks that I tumbled in this first batch. And they've been through all the stages. And anybody who's a rock tumbler, you're going to look at them and you're going to think, I'm not sure that these turned out so well. But I think they actually did turn out perfectly. So in addition to these questions that I had about how to successfully tumble rocks, I also kept coming back to a more fundamental question. Why do we collect these things in the first place? Like, what's the point? What is it about rocks that compels us to pick them up, to clean and polish them, to display them, to share them? Many folks shared in pre-talk that they've received rocks as gifts or given them as gifts. There are pet rocks. There are birthstones, state stones, cairns, you know, those rocks that you find stacked in the park or on the beach. I hope maybe, who brought a rock with you this morning? I'm hoping a good, healthy number. Cool. Okay. I'm going to ask you to turn to the person next to you, and I want you to share your rock story with them. If you don't have a rock, with you, but you have a rock in your on your kitchen counter, like Chris said. Share the story of that rock. And I want, hold on just a second. Hold on. Tink, tink, tink. I've lost control. That's it. What I want you to do, what do you know about the rock? What do you know about that rock? How did you come to have that rock? Why do you keep it? And what's the meaning that it has for you? So take a few minutes. Yes, I'll repeat it. What do you know about the rock? How did you come to get it? Why did you keep it? And what meaning does it have for you? So let's take a couple minutes and then we'll come back. And if you don't have a rock, just join with somebody who has one and talk about their rock. Go ahead and wrap up your stories and come back in just a second. What does that say? Starve the ego. Let's go ahead and come back. The audio on this is going to be great for anybody who's listening to it as a podcast. So, what did you notice about the energy in the room as you talked about these rocks? Like, woo, as soon as I said, let's talk about our rocks, you were like, all in. You're like turning to each other, and I heard all this laughing and smiling and just leaning into each other and connecting around these rocks. So this exchange of stories gives you an idea of why rocks are part of our collective experience. A quick sort of scientific note, as I talk about this going forward, I'm going to use the words rock and stone interchangeably. I actually had to Google, is there a difference between a stone and a rock? And there is. A stone is part of a rock. So you might go to that logic of saying all stones are rocks, but not all rocks are stones, or you know, something like that. And so if you want to go into the dark corners of the internet where they split hairs on potato, potato, you can do a search to learn more. But I'm not going to get into it. For our purposes, I'm just going to use them interchangeably since they're more alike than they are different. So there are lots of personal reasons why a rock might be significant. And I believe there are several universal reasons that form the foundation of this. And I actually had to Google. I didn't have to Google it, but I decided, you know, I'm going to do my own reflection and then I'm going to Google, why do people collect rocks? Thank you, Google. But rocks have a tremendous amount of variety. I'm guessing nobody's rock in here is like anybody else's rock. The colors, the textures, the sizes, the shapes, the markings, they're just cool, right? It's like a treasure. And rocks are everywhere. They're from the oceans to the deserts to the plains and mountains to rainforests to the Arctic Circle. And they're products of our environment without any human intervention. And as I shared at the start, they're really, really, really old. They're shaped by time and elements. They have witnessed the entire history of the world. As British artist and environmentalist Andy Goldsworthy has said, a stone is ingrained with geological and historical memories. They're a constant piece of earth that doesn't melt, evaporate, die, rot, fade, or freeze. that something organic could be that old and virtually indestructible unless humans intervene. That kind of goes against logic. On a fundamental level, they connect us to the earth. Another quote from Andy Goldsworthy reminds us, we often forget that we are nature. Nature is not something separate from us. So when we say we have lost our connection with nature, we've lost our connection to ourselves. By collecting stones and rocks, we're recollecting something ancient in our nature. And then when we were young, most of us learned about our birthstones. I bet everybody in here could probably name their month birthstone and what meaning was attached to it. My birthstone is sapphire, September. And according to the American Gem Society, the celestial blue color of this gemstone symbolized heaven and attracted divine favor and wise judgment. Greeks wore sapphire for guidance when seeking answers from the oracle. Buddhists believe that it brought spiritual enlightenment, and Hindus used it in worship. Now, both my engagement ring and my wedding rings feature sapphire, and I remember reading somewhere that it also stood for constancy and truth. Now, seriously. Really? Those are a lot of traits to ascribe to an object that isn't alive, that has no consciousness. But when you look up just about any stone, precious or not, you'll find that people believe that it has certain powers or energies. People use stones as talismans, carried for protection, or believing that they have healing or spiritual powers. Such beliefs are kind of fantastical in that they can't be proven. But they are, nonetheless, what draws many of us to collect and place meaning in them. Holding a stone can be therapeutic. I mean, how many of you have your stone and you just, when you hold it in your hand, there's something that's very calming and grounding and soothing about it. There's even a practice called rock therapy that uses rocks as a catalyst for talking about your emotions. But the therapy most of us get from rocks is more about experiencing them as solid, substantial, soothing, cool, grounding. Even if they are inert objects, we project characteristics such as resilience and strength through expressions like solid as a rock. And as we talked about in pre-talk, we imbue them with memories. That's a huge part of the therapeutic benefit from rocks. And from a religious and spiritual perspective, we've heard about rocks our entire lives. There are close to 100 mentions of rocks and stones in the Bible, and I found it kind of surprising, only 100. I would think that there would be way more, but they've left an indelible image in our minds. Some of the more memorable verses, so Matthew 16:18, and this is from the New International Version. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Psalm 18:2, and this is in your bulletin, a message translation. I love you, God. You make me strong. God is my bedrock under my feet, the castle in which I live, where I run for dear life, hiding behind the boulders, safe in the granite hideout. In the New International Version, it uses the phrase, the Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer, which is also probably very familiar to you. And in Genesis, in the message, this is a reading that my husband brought to my attention recently. Jacob was up first thing in the morning. He took the stone he had used for his pillow and stood it up as a memorial pillar and poured oil over it. He christened the place Bethel, God's house. Beth. The name of the town had been Luz until then. Jacob vowed a vow. If God stands by me and protects me on this journey on which I'm setting out, keeps me in good food and clothing, and brings me back in one piece to my father's house, this God will be my God. This stone that I have set up as a memorial pillar will mark this place where God lives. And everything you give me, I'll return a tenth to you. I imagine that's where tithing comes from. So Andy mentioned this reading to me since he knew I was preparing this talk. He didn't know, though, that the night before, I had just taken, where are the rocks now? Somewhere, I hope, moving around. I had just taken those out of the tumbler and had been rinsing them off, and I didn't think they were shiny enough, so I decided to put some oil on them. Is that a coincidence, or is that some sort of unconscious at work? I don't know, but You can tell that this was maybe a challenging talk for me to put together. I just thought of the idea like a week and a half ago or so, and as you can tell from what I've shared already, there's like a million and one rabbit holes that I could go down. From what rocks teach us about the Earth's evolution and our treatment of it today, so a more environmental message, to the ways that they function to keep living creatures sheltered, industrious, and even fed, to the sacred and energetic stories they tell when we use them physically, symbolically, spiritually, and metaphorically. So I decided it was enough to remind us of all of those things so that you can go down the rabbit hole of your choosing. It feels more useful to focus on the lessons learned from the rocks rather than talking about the rocks. These are reflections based on my newbie tumbling experience and the questions it's raised about our connection to them that feel relevant to where we are here at the beginning of 2025. So here's what I've come up with so far. It's rational to love rocks. I started to feel like, oh, this is not rational, this is not normal, but it's rational. There's something solid and tangible in a world that is increasingly virtual and hard to grasp. Unlike most things in our lives that are meant to be disposable, they are not going anywhere. Their weight is more than just a measurement. It's evidence of thousands of years of existence, layer upon layer of life happening around and to it. If you find comfort in that, if holding a rock feels satisfying and balancing, embrace that. There's a reason rocks are used in rituals and ceremonies, carried in pockets like the one I have in mine, worn in fingers and around necks. They are a piece of the earth that we can safely and consistently carry with us and that remind us that we are nature. And I'm going to make a practice of carrying a rock around with me everywhere I go this year, whether it's in my pocket or a purse or in a piece of jewelry. It can serve to ground me and maybe even act as a million-year-old pacifier in slowing me down and reminding me to breathe. Another lesson is that beauty is everywhere. It is right under our feet, and we have to stay awake to it. Also in your bulletin, from Annie Dillard, crystals grew inside rock like arithmetic flowers. They lengthened and spread, added plane to plane in an odd and perfect obedience to an absolute geometry that even stones, maybe even only stones, understood. And from Isaac Asimov, it is strange, but rocks, properly chosen and polished, can be as beautiful as flowers and much more durable. Something I've learned as a photographer is not to just look at what's in front of me. I have to look side to side, behind me, up and down. Most often it's in looking down that we find the rocks. So we all have an opportunity to make looking for stones a practice that brings some sacredness and unexpected beauty into our lives. Now here are the lessons that I find that are kind of my favorite that we talked about in pre-talk. Grit. A lot of grit is required to shape a stone. There are at least four stages in a tumbling cycle, and each is anywhere from 6 to 8 days. And that means that the entire process can take a month or more. And in our modern instant gratification era, that seems like an eternity. The coarser grits help to smooth out the rock, and each stage uses increasingly finer grit. Polishing is the last step. It's like finishing school. And it's helped me to redefine the stages of life. When you're younger, there's a lot of grit that you have to survive and that shapes you into the person you are. And it's because of grit that we develop grit, that we develop resilience. And by the time you reach middle age, you're in the pre-polishing stage. The edges have mostly been smoothed off, but there's always a work in progress. The logical conclusion is that as you mature and as you reach that final stage, you're not old, you're polished. So I hope that sinks in. You're not old, you're polished. You're welcome. The other thing that's important in tumbling is cushion. A lot of tumbling and friction is needed to polish rocks. It's going 24/7 for 30 days or more. The friction from the grit is balanced by adding water along with other media, like plastic or plastic pellets or ceramic little pieces. And that helps to cushion the stones And as the literature says, it keeps them from bruising. We all need that balance of friction and cushion. Without friction and a bit of tumbling, we wouldn't be able to become who we fully are. Adversity and resistance are part of life, whether we like it or not. That's why the cushions are so important. Yes, that includes the couch cushions that we nap on and rest and Netflix and chill. But other cushions, like hugs, are more important. Family and communities, like C3, are cushions. A cushion is anything that helps to catch us before we fall and gives us a soft place to land when we inevitably do fall. The other lesson is humility. When you're tumbling rocks, you put in a lot of work, and you can do everything right, and they still might not come out the way you expect. And isn't that the lesson of life? When it comes to that first batch of rocks to polish, I thought I was doing everything by the book and being careful. And still, out of my batch of 15 or so stones, when you passed that around, you saw really only one, a yellow jasper, actually polished. After all of the work and the mess and the waiting to rinse them off after that final polish and see that most of them weren't polished, I admit to feeling a flash of disappointment. Like, what did I do wrong? I've seen plenty of posts titled, "Why aren't my rocks shiny?" and didn't think it would happen to me, because by golly, I did everything right. They must have done something wrong. They must not have followed directions. But it did happen to me. I rinsed them and burnished them, where you tumble them for a little while in some flakes of ivory soap, and nothing changed. But as I handled them, I found myself appreciating the smooth, matte surface. They looked perfect in that bowl, the soft glow that they had. I put them in that bowl that I was gifted a few weeks ago, and I think they look perfect. We can put a lot of effort into something only to have it fall short of our expectations. And we could call that a failure or a mistake. Or, as I think I've shared up here before, we can just say plot twist and adjust our expectations. Any disappointment that we feel shows that we cared. We were invested. It means we had a relationship, and we don't abandon our relationships, even with rocks, just because something didn't turn out as we expected. We recalibrate. We find a way to accept and even embrace the reality. We try again, and if we've learned from it, things usually get better. The other thing that is important is patience. Patience is required. There are no shortcuts to rock tumbling. Everything takes longer than you think. Giving something more time is almost always a good idea. Since the rocks are out of sight like 99% of the process and transformation is taking place in that barrel, I've come to think of a tumbler as a womb. If a thing is important, we owe it space to evolve and to be birthed the way that it wants to be. Rushing it along and cutting corners leads to disappointment, and we end up spending more time fixing the situation that we rushed than if we had just let it play out as it was supposed to. The process of rock tumbling has a great way of keeping a perspective on time. Without the tumbler, a rock would need hundreds, if not thousands, of years to become smooth. With the tumbler, we can do it in 4 weeks. What's 4 weeks compared to thousands of years? Nothing. Maybe this fact is useful to us to remember when we're feeling impatient about a situation in our lives. Unless it's life and death, there's almost nothing that can't benefit from slowing down and practicing patience. I think it's safe to say that the coming year is going to test our patience and our humility and our grit. We're going to need a lot of cushion for those times when we feel like we can't take any more stress or we're being tested beyond what we think we can handle. When there's uncertainty in the air over something that we can't control, we have to turn to what we know for sure. Ruth, who taught a few weeks ago, alluded to this in her talk. To keep ourselves grounded, we focus on that which doesn't change. The sun rising in the east and setting in the west, the love of our pets and our family, the changing of the seasons, the birds and the squirrels going about their business. They don't care who's president. sand beneath your toe, between your toes, and tree canopies above your head, the bliss of a nap in a hammock on a warm evening, and that basement of rocks in the earth that can offer us so much amazement. Remember last week when Spencer sang, "We collect things"? Collecting things brings comfort and security. It can evoke memories and connect us to another time and place. They are another cushion. In that spirit, allow yourself to give meaning to anything that helps you, anything that's useful, whether you have one or 100 of them. It doesn't matter if it's a rock, a piece of jewelry, a scarf or a tie, or a pair of lucky socks. Those objects have energy in them because of what we project onto them. And while someone might scoff at that, who cares? If it doesn't work for you, then don't do it. But if you find yourself getting comfort and energy and healing and power from something like a stone, then embrace that. I think of it like prayer. Does saying a prayer for yourself or someone else really make a difference? Will it help with the pain or trauma or need? I'm going to make a reference that I hope a lot of you will get, but as Nate Bargatze says in the SNL skit, Washington's Dream, nobody knows. If you don't know that reference, look it up. It's worth your time. But if it helps you as the prayer sayer, if it helps you feel like you're doing something, if it offers comfort or a feeling of acceptance, then it's worth doing. Should we depend on prayers or stones to the exclusion of everything else? Definitely not. That would not be safe. But we can add them to our toolbox of coping mechanisms. Whatever helps you to stay grounded in the midst of chaos or discomfort, use it. See it as a catalyst. If you carry a rock in your pocket or wear a piece of jewelry, connect with it during times of stress as a reminder to breathe, to pause, to smile, or do whatever is useful to you in that moment. Make it a gift to someone else. I think of Shrinking. If anyone has watched Shrinking, one of the main characters is named Liz, and she tumbles and polishes rocks. And she gives them as gifts to people she loves. And if you get a rock from Liz, you have made it. And there's something about that that is powerful. So think about rocks as gifts too. One way that rocks have been used to bring healing is through kindness rocks. Many of you have likely either made one yourself or you have come across one. They're placed in random public spots, and they're meant to be kept by the person who finds them, or they can be relocated so that they stay in circulation. And the intention is to bring good energy. You never know who's going to pick it up and what it will mean to them. Someone might find a "you've got this" rock just when they thought they were about to break down. I'm sure that that happens. So at a time when it feels like there's high potential for anxiety, we will choose healing. Instead of talk back today, we're going to make some kindness rocks. See, I told you this was going to be participatory. On the back, we're going to set up some tables. And you might have brought a rock today that you're willing to paint. If not, I have plenty of them, along with some acrylic markers, and we can just go to town. I've brought maybe about 40 or 50 rocks back there. So markers are on hand for you to paint your own rock today. You can take it with you, or you can leave it with me, and I will take it home and seal it and bring it back next Sunday. Your message, the art, it doesn't have to be fancy. We're not expecting, you know, the Mona Lisa. It just has to be sincere. And whenever it's ready, I hope that you'll leave it on a ledge, in a bathroom stall, in a shopping basket, on a table, in the crook of a tree, on a bench, somewhere where it can be found by a stranger. Let's do our part to spread a little kindness and be the light. Thanks.